ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's a compounding number of issues that all festivals are juggling at the moment. You know, obviously the cost of living with, you know, so many Australians doing it quite tough these days. And there has been a huge increase in event costs since COVID.
2024 has proven to be a challenging year for music festivals. Splendour in the Grass, Groove in the Moo, Caloundra, Fairbridge, they're just some that have been cancelled for this year. Shortly we'll hear from the organiser of the Woodford Folk Festival on what it takes to put on a festival in 2024. And on Tasmania's Wild West Coast, towns have risen and fallen at the whim of industry. Some of their oldest living inhabitants remember their former homes and how their communities came undone. We'll hear what lessons can be learnt from these small ghost towns so that more small communities remain viable into the future.
The fact that towns rise and fall, that are born and then die because their existence has depended on a single commodity or a single mine, is something that's been characteristic of human history down the ages.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. But firstly, the idea of a four-day work week sounds appealing to many workers, and in recent years there have been successful trials by a number of companies. But if you have school students at home, how would you go with a four-day school week in your household? A high school in New South Wales made headlines last year when it announced it would trial a four-day school week. But rather than a day off, Chevalier College in Bowral is giving its senior students the option of learning remotely one day a week. Students still need to complete a certain amount of work and mark their attendance each Monday morning. The school says it helps prepare students better for tertiary learning or even the workforce. Tim Fernandez caught up with Year 12 student Sheridan Connolly at her home near Picton. She's been part of the flexible learning trial.
Sheridan Connolly's Mondays are a little different to most high school students. Instead of travelling up to an hour and a half each way to school, she spends the start of the week learning from home.
Well, I really like it because I can spend that either studying or catching up on sleep or just spending it in a way that works for me.
Sheridan Connolly is one of more than 100 senior students at Chevalier College in the New South Wales Southern Highlands who are taking part in a new trial.
There was the rumour that it's a four-day week. It's not a four-day week. Like, the Monday, you still get allocated work that you have to do. There's still set work. So we can email our teacher if we need help. So say a maths problem I'm having an issue in with, I'll just email my teacher and they can help me. But really it's just to regulate your learning yourself. And so, say, personally, I really like it because it's individually paced. So in a classroom, there might be that pressure of having to keep up with the other students. But at home, you can really modify the learning. So there is set work that you have to do. But then, say, after the school day ends, then you can go back through multiple resources and really say, if you're a visual learner, learn things visually and then read more articles and really go in more in depth.
Obviously, Year 12 is a really stressful time. You're sort of preparing for these massive exams and, you know, everyone, you know, gets stressed out in their HSC year, you know, and it can be quite daunting. Do you find that this new flexible learning arrangement helps, just helps you with your mental health?
Yeah, I think definitely, as it really takes a load off, I feel like, as in, so I play a Saturday sport. So I have training twice a week, Tuesday afternoon, Thursday afternoon, and then a game on Saturday. And normally that game I might have to travel, so I have to travel to school or travel to another school. And so really, Saturdays I don't have as much time as I'd like to study. And I also do have a job. So before this flipped learning Monday, I not necessarily struggled to find time, but I was stressed about finding time to get all my homework complete and then the extra work that you have to do in Year 12.
Sheridan's mother, Laura, says it's a game changer for her daughter and her classmates.
We've had a very good experience, and Sheridan has actually really blossomed in a way.
But there were initial concerns. When the school announced the change last year, parents were worried their child's education would suffer. Some even pulled their kids out of the school. Rebecca Graham is the assistant principal at Chevalier College. She says part of the challenge has been explaining the goals of the program.
Schools like ours often have quite a big dropout rate once kids get to university because they have being spoon-fed, using that old terminology, and they haven't had to be self-directed and understand that it's up to me.
Rebecca Graham says the school has been surveying students involved in the trial, and the positive results has won some parents over.
Their big question as to why. Why are we doing this? And I think once our students and our parents understand the why, they've really come on board.
It's Louise Glace. I'm a visual arts teacher, but I'm also the Stage 6 coordinator with an academic focus. There's plenty of checks and balances. So as a classroom teacher, we're monitoring our students on a weekly basis. Are they, you know, when we come back to school on a Tuesday in our face-to-face lessons, we're, you know, assessing where they got up to with the flipped learning. It's part of our broader discussions and developing a continuum of lessons where it's flipped learning, but it's superficial. We go onto the deep level and then we head towards transfer level of learning as well. So it's an effective way of structuring your lessons, students learning independently but becoming or coming to class prepared for the lessons ahead.
The flexibility also means teachers like Louise Glaze can better help students and better help herself.
I've been able to, on my Mondays, co-plan with colleagues. I've been able to have time to myself to actually do core business.
Remote learning is not a new concept for Australian school students who were forced to do so during the COVID lockdowns, but only a few schools have kept the flexibility.
I think, unfortunately, most schools probably are returning back to where we were before COVID when it comes to the flexibility and how the school is organised and what it looks like.
That's University of Melbourne Education Professor Parsi Salberg. He says it's difficult to say how many Australian schools are adopting flexibility as the data isn't collected. But Australian kids spend more time in the classroom than kids in any other developed country, and that doesn't always lead to better results.
The research evidence is very clear that the instruction time, in other words, how long children spend in school, how long their school days or school years are, has very little to do with the actual quality of the learning outcomes.
The school will decide whether to adopt flexible learning permanently at the end of the year.
Our reporter Tim Fernandez with that story.
ABC Australia Wide.
And you're with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company. Let's stay with education. In some parts of the country, schools and parents are dealing with a lack of teachers. But in one small community in regional WA, the very opposite problem needed tackling. Last year, Gardner Primary School hit the point where it had no students as parents chose to take their children to other schools. But a husband and wife principal and teacher duo made their way from the big smoke of Perth to help out. They've had some good results so far in reinvigorating the school. Jamie Tanu has this story.
It's the first day of term two for the students of Gardner Primary School. The school students have all had a long bus ride to get here this morning, so they're having breakfast with their teachers, as they always do to start the day. There's only 9 kids here at this relatively small school in a fairly remote part of Southern WA, but they're all happy and keen to learn.
And what do you guys like about school?
Library.
We're going to eat.
Get to eat? Breakfast, lunch?
So we keep our energy up and we don't come up.
I like the library because it's really good. Well, I like reading a lot.
You might not know it looking at these cheerful kids and enthusiastic teachers, but there was a point last year where Gardner Primary didn't have any students. In these small farming communities, these tiny schools can be a real blessing. Tight-knit bonds can be formed and kids can get a lot of attention from their teachers. But when things go wrong, there can be big consequences.
We decided to move our son to one of the other neighbouring schools just as a measure of being heard. We were down to not strong numbers, weren't getting support where we needed it as far as looking after our kids' education.
At the start of 2022, the school had 24 students. That dropped to 7 at the start of 2023, and then at the mid-year point, it hit 0. Parents said the relationship between some former staff and the community was so tense and unwelcoming that they decided their kids were better off going to another school that was half an hour or even further away.
We always intended to bring him back because we live in Gardner. We have our community here in Gardner. It was always our intention to come back once we were happy with what was moving forward.
That's when a young family arrived. Sean and Anna Ward, as well as their young daughter, made the move from Perth to Gardner.
It was a big change. I've come from Perth Metro. It certainly was a big change, but the community has been nothing but welcoming.
Mr. Ward, now Gardner's principal, had taught at schools in Perth and the United Kingdom with hundreds of students. This was a very new challenge.
It was probably certainly a culture shock for both of us, but I think we recognised as a family the uniqueness of the opportunity.
Mr. Ward said his priority was reaching out to the community to let them know he was committed to their school.
We had a parent evening, a community evening at the school for a barbecue, treated it as a bit of a Q&A, speak to community, engage, get their side of the stories, things that they found frustrating previously, and then, yeah, just sort of work together where we can.
Soon the first kids were coming back and the school needed another teacher. So Anna took on the role.
I came from a school of almost 800 students, so walking into a school of zero was a shock. It was very sad initially. We have such a beautiful school, and to see it empty and not being used for all it's worth was quite upsetting. But the day, week five, that those kids walked in, it was a beautiful moment, and they've just slotted right back in. Tried to do little things like make sure that when they get to school they have breakfast and they have a play, and take into account that even though their ride is not as long as it was at one point, it's still pretty long.
It's these touches that have won back trust, according to parents.
When Sean got on board and the strategies he put in and the care factor was back, if you know what I mean. So he cared for the kids, he cared for this school.
While 9 students is not quite the level the school was at a couple of years ago, both parents and staff believe it will continue growing.
Generally within the community, I think the perception is that we're on the right track. The feedback's been really positive about the direction that we're headed in. So there's certainly plenty of reasons to be optimistic.
We are just loving it back here at Gardner. Everything feels good, it's welcoming, and yeah, you just get back to the sense of Gardner's a whole community again.
Albany reporter Jamie Tanu with that story. 2024 has proven to be a challenging year for music festivals. Regional touring festival Groove in the Moo was cancelled, the iconic Splendour in the Grass near Byron, WA Fairbridge Folk Festival announced it would not be going ahead, and just this week we have heard that the Caloundra Music Festival will be paused for 2024. So where does that leave the remaining festivals on the schedule, and how can they endure the commercial pressures that have seen others cancelled? The Woodford Folk Festival is a much-loved and long-running music event on the calendar. It's been going for nearly 40 years. Sunshine Coast reporter Alex Easton asked organiser Amanda Jacks, the managing director of Woodfordia, if Woodford will definitely be going ahead this year.
Yes, I'm pleased to be able to say that Woodford is going ahead this year, and we will be launching tickets in late May.
What is it about Woodford that makes it different to these other festivals, to festivals like Groove in the Moo and Splendour and Caloundra?
I mean, we're facing the same challenges that those festivals have faced as well. So, I mean, it's a compounding number of issues that all festivals are juggling at the moment. You know, obviously the cost of living with, you know, so many Australians doing it quite tough these days. And there has been a huge increase in event costs since COVID, you know, between 30 and 40% in some areas. Climate impacts are ongoing and the high cost of insurance. But back to your question about, well, how come Woodford is going to, you know, be able to move through this? Woodford comes from a very large base of community people that are involved in the festival, as well as having a 37-year history, which we've had to meet quite a number of challenges over those years. And we've been very blessed with the purchase of our own land, which means that each year as we've improved the land, we've been able to slightly reduce those operational overheads each year. So in some cases, like we have 64 permanent amenity blocks. if we were hiring 64 permanent amenity blocks these days, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars in hire fees and transport fees and getting the plumbers and the electricians to connect them. So each year, you know, over since we've been at Woodford, just being able to keep building a little bit better infrastructure each year has certainly helped us a little bit with those infrastructure costs.
You mentioned Woodford's 37-year history, which is a reminder that this is something that organisationally, at least, Woodford's seen before. So, like, during the time that Woodford has been doing very well, you've had the rise and fall of Big Day Out and Livid, which were huge festivals in the 90s and then suddenly crashed.
Yes, and I suppose we've learnt over the years, just in some years, we actually align ourselves with farmers more than any other industry. We work the whole year on, you know, the crop, and we get a very small window to harvest that crop. And just like farmers, you know, they have to actually just really be resilient over the years to be able to be back and be able to do the farming in following years. You know, a lot of people say to us, oh, Woodford, it, you know, keeps growing each year. And it doesn't. Festivals, audiences do go up and down. They respond to, you know, what's going on in the economy. They respond to climate issues. We know that when we've had wet festivals, it takes us a few years to recover from that. So, you know, the attendance of festivals is really fluctuates over the years. And that teaches us that, you know, we need to be able to tighten our belts some years. But also in the tough years, we need to try and be ambitious as well. And that's certainly what we're going to be with the program at this year's Woodford Folk Festival.
So there's more sort of flexibility over time because of what you've seen and experienced in the past?
Yeah, and also developing the businesses within the festival. Like, you know, post-COVID, we launched something called Lake Gula Camping, and we opened the grounds to school holiday camping for 2 weeks over the Easter holidays and the September-October holidays. So we developed that up as a business. We actually launched our own distiller, Woodford Cellars brand, and we distilled all of the spirits for our bars this year, which helped us be able to sharpen the pencil on costs in that area. And we actually, the Woodfordia gin that we developed, which has beautiful botanics from the site, actually was the standout drink served at our bars at the festival. We built Lake Gula Camp, Lake Gula, which is the largest natural human-made recreation lake in the Southern Hemisphere. And that we did that because we were seeing a decline in our season campers at the festival. And our season campers, they're the patrons that are kind of the backbone, the community at the event. And we were concerned that, you know, with increasing heat over the Queensland summers and with climate change, that we needed something that was a bit of a reprieve for our campers. So we built this magnificent lake, and that lake is, you know, it's an additional business to the organisation. So I think we've had to work hard to see how can we turn different elements at the festival into being able to generate a little bit of income, so it's not all for the box office to do all the heavy lifting.
That was Amanda Jacks, the Managing Director of Woodfordia Inc., talking there on the state of festivals around the country, and she confirmed Woodford Folk Festival will be going ahead with a lineup due to be announced in October. And finally, let's head off the mainland and down to Tasmania. For a long time, towns on Tassie's west coast have ridden the boom and bust of the forestry, hydroelectric and mining industries. Some towns survived and some didn't. So what determined whether they lived or died? And are there lessons to be learned from those that didn't make it? A reporter, Meg Powell, went traipsing around some old Tassie ghost towns to find out.
This pianola once sat in a hotel that no longer exists. It's a relic of a town that died last century. Gormanston was a mining town buried in the mountains of Tasmania's wild west coast. It was once home to 2,000 people, a courthouse, a jail, a school, and 8 pubs. But the town's population began to dwindle in the 1920s after the nearby Iron Blow mine was phased out.
Oh, I come up every now and again and have a wander around and
us remember where things used to be and what it used to be like.
Ralph Burns is one of the oldest original residents.
I'm originally from Gormas and 27 years here before I got married and I had to move down to Queenstown. Well, this area here, just here, was the Federation Hotel there. And you see those two iron bars sticking up there? That's where the bakery used to be.
Right.
And as far as I know to this day, the oven is still in amongst all that rubble. I thought it was very good, you know. We had plenty to do. We made our own fun, walked around all these hills. You know. And we had a great time growing up. It's a bit sad in a way, but it's a shame it's been let go the way it's been let go. But hopefully down the track, maybe not in my time, the government might start building houses up here, you know, because they're going to need places to build houses eventually because of the population growth. Yeah.
Gormanston is not the only ghost town in the area whose fate has rested on the success of a single industry.
Oh, a lot of them are not very big.
Historian Michael Holmes says nearly 70 towns have disappeared from Tasmania's west coast since European settlement.
And the construction of railways. So primary reason is that they run out of resource, particularly in mining, and second one is changes in technology like cars replaced horses or footwork. Their telephone and internet has changed dramatically the circumstances, and they've finished building the railway or they've finished building the dam.
Saul Eslek, independent economist, Vice-Chancellor's Fellow at the University of Tasmania.
Well, at the time of Federation, in the 1890s and in the 1910s, mining was one of the most important activities in Tasmania, and although we don't have accurate figures, it probably accounted for well over 10% of Tasmania's economy. As recently as the mid-1970s, mining appeared to account for about 8% of Tasmania's economy, and most of that, of course, was concentrated on the west coast. Today, however, mining accounts for barely 4% of Tasmania's economy. It's still the mainstay of the west coast, of course, but it's not as big on the west coast as it used to be, and there's less mining activity in other parts of Tasmania, such as the Fingal Valley or around Methina or at Beaconsfield, as there used to be. Well, it's always risky to have your economic eggs in one basket, and that applies to nations as much as it does to states or individual towns and cities. Other parts of Australia are littered with towns that sprung up in order to exploit a mineral resource, and when that mineral resource was fully exploited and run down and there was nothing else for people in the town to do, the town died. You can see ghost towns across Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland, South Australia and Western Australia. And of course, we've got them too. There are also towns, for example, in the northwest coast of Tasmania, out the back of Smithton, that used to depend on a particular agricultural industry or on forestry that are no longer there anymore because that industry either died or moved away.
While Gormanston died at the whim of big business,
something different killed Burn Bradshaw's village.
The thriving sawmill town of Princess River was built around the production of rare Tasmanian timbers, Huon pine, myrtle, sassafras and kingbilly.
I live in Queenstown these days. I'll be 94 next month, yeah. Well, the time the flooding was due, Dad had passed away, and the chap from the land department rang me this day and said, Mr Bradshaw, we have to inform you that you have to leave. And I said, I can't afford to leave. They said, you have to leave. It's going to be flooded.
By the early 1990s, the small village was under what became Lake Burbury, drowned to make way for a new venture, hydroelectricity.
So, you know, the houses and the mill and everything like that was had to be abandoned. They pulled most of the houses down and, you know, there was 80-odd truckloads of stuff come into here from Princess when we move.
Of the many industry towns that have lived and died, at least two of them, Strawn and Queenstown, reinvented themselves as tourist destinations.
The fact that towns rise and fall, that are born and then die because their existence has depended on a single commodity or a single mine, is something that's been characteristic of human history down the ages. I think the lesson is that towns and communities need to try, if they can, to have more than one string to their bow.
The pianola that once stood in a pub in the ghost town of Gormanston. Finishing up that report by Meg Powell from the west coast of Tasmania. And that is Australia Wide for this Thursday. I'm Alex Hyman. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.